Welcome to the April 2016 edition of Annotated Bibliography Podcast, also known as Journal Scan or This Month in Other Journals Besides the AJNR. I'm Jeff Ross, and for this edition, I've selected 9 articles from the recent literature that I found of interest, and I hope you will find them of interest as well. The references that I'm discussing, as usual, will be posted into the AJNR blog for your convenience. The first paper has a first author of Benarouche, and it's entitled Choroid Plexus CSF System, Recent Developments in Clinical Correlations. This is from Neurology in 2016. This is an excellent comprehensive review of the role and function of the choroid plexus in health and disease, and has 2 tables and 1 graphic. Fun facts that you've learned and probably forgotten, here are a few of them. I know I've forgotten them. 80% of CSF is secreted by the choroid plexus, about 20% from brain interstitial space. The choroid plexus secretes CSF at a rate of 0.4 milliliter per minute per gram of tissue, and that comes out to about 500 cc's per day. The total volume is 150 cc's, so the CSF exchanges 3 to 4 times per day. Main determinants of CSF secretion are the active secretion of sodium via the sodium-potassium ATPase and the production of bicarbonate by actions of the carbonic anhydrase in the choroid epithelial cells. There are 3 parts of the glymphatic system, that's G-L-Y-M-P-H-A-T-I-C. The first is para-arterial CSF influx. The second is paravenous interstitial fluid clearance route, and the third is a transparenchymal pathway, which depends upon astroglial water transport via aquaporin 4 channels. The glymphatic system is estimated to remove 40 to 80% of solutes and proteins, including important things such as amyloid beta peptide and tau, all from the superficial cortex. Let's go on to the second paper, which has a first author of CUI, probably mispronounced. That's entitled Intraoperative MRI for Optimizing Electrode Placement for Deep Brain Stimulation of the Subthalamic Nucleus in Parkinson's Disease. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery, 2016. The authors note that various methods have been used to localize the subthalamic nucleus, including MRI, brain atlas imaging fusion for preoperative planning, intraoperative microelectrode recording, intraoperative MRI, temporary efficacy during the operation, postoperative MR, and sustained effect during the postoperative period. In this study, 206 electrodes were implanted in the subthalamic nucleus in 110 patients with Parkinson's disease. All patients underwent intraoperative MR after implantation to define the accuracy of the lead placement. 56 electrode positions in 35 patients deviated from the center of the subthalamic nucleus, according to the result of the initial post-placement intraoperative MR study. After adjustment with intraoperative MR, all electrodes were located in the center of the subthalamic nucleus. Intraoperative MR revealed 2 intraparenchymal hemorrhages in 2 patients, brain shift in all patients, and leads penetrating the lateral ventricle in 3 patients. They conclude that the use of intraoperative MR allows surgeons to access and adjust the position of the electrodes to better achieve placement in the center of the subthalamic nucleus. Now, this seems like intraoperative microelectrode recording is the way to go in the United States. I've never been personally involved in or seeing an intraoperative MR positioning of these leads versus the usual intraoperative microelectrode recording. Certainly, we do it for preoperative planning and general postoperative evaluation for hemorrhage or other complications, but intraoperative, I haven't seen. Third paper has a first author of Davis, and it is entitled Glutamate Imaging, or GLUCEST, G-L-U-C-E-S-T, lateralizes epileptic foci in non-lesional temporal lobe epilepsy. This is in Science Translational Medicine from 2015. Human and animal studies have suggested that glutamate can serve as a marker of epileptic networks and supports the hypothesis that glutamate is elevated in epileptogenic foci. MR spectroscopy studies in patients designed to measure glutamate have been performed with lower field MR systems, and the results have been inconclusive. Unlike the resonances of N-acetyl aspartate and creatine, which are singlets, glutamate's resonances are triplets or higher order multiplets, resulting in smaller spectral peaks distributed over a broader range of frequencies. Additionally, glutamate shows spectral overlap with glutamine. The chemical exchange saturation transfer technique, CESS technique, measures proton exchange between the exchangeable protons of the solute with the much larger pool of bulk water protons. For glutamate, the amine proton resonates at 3 parts per million downfield from water, making glutamate a good neurotransmitter for chemical exchange saturation transfer imaging with MR scanners of 7 Tesla and higher. So they looked at 4 non-lesional drug-resistant epilepsy patients and 11 healthy controls. In all 4 epilepsy patients, concentrations of glutamate were higher in the epileptogenic ipsilateral hippocampus than in the contralateral hippocampus, both qualitatively and quantitatively. They conclude that they have demonstrated the feasibility of lateralizing seizure foci in temporal lobe epilepsy and suggest that this type of MR imaging, GLU-CEST, could also potentially localize drug-resistant neocortical epilepsy, where current epilepsy imaging techniques are even more limited. So in the end, very small numbers, but a very interesting result. On to paper number 4, that is the first author of SICAR, and it's entitled Schizophrenia Risk from Complex Variation of Complement Component 4, and this is from Nature in 2016. So this is a very complex study that I don't pretend to understand its entirety, but it points to a potential underlying mechanism for schizophrenia. To start with, complement component 4, or C4, is a critical component of the classical complement cascade, part of the innate immune system pathway that rapidly recognizes and eliminates pathogens and cellular debris. In the brain, other genes in the classical complement cascade have been implicated in the elimination or pruning of synapses. Schizophrenia's strongest genetic association involves variation in the major histocompatibility complex, or MHC, locus. The authors show that this association arises in part from many structurally diverse alleles of the C4 genes. They found that these alleles generated widely varying levels of C4a and C4b expression in the brain, with each common C4 allele associating with schizophrenia in proportion to its tendency to generate greater expression of C4a. They did this all by analyzing single nucleotide polymorphism data from 28,799 schizophrenia cases and 35,986 controls from 40 cohorts in 22 countries contributing to the Psychiatric Genomics Consortium. Paper number 5 ties that in. This is an editorial by Dehindra, and it's entitled Schizophrenia from Genetics to Physiology at Last, and this is from Nature in 2016. A very useful editorial summarizing the SICAR paper, as Dr. Dehindra states, quote, although pruning undoubtedly represents a challenging therapeutic target, the author's beautiful and comprehensive study gives much-needed inspiration for all those researchers who are trying to leverage genetics to advance our understanding of the biology of neuropsychiatric diseases, close quote. So I guess we should all strive for publishing a research paper that is described as beautiful. On to number 6. That is a first author of GRADE, and it's entitled A Neuroradiologist's Guide to Arterial Spin Labeling MRI in Clinical Practice. This is from Neuroradiology in 2015. So this is an excellent review of ASL, starting with basic principles, types of labeling such as continuous ASL, pseudo-continuous ASL, and pulsed ASL, but also covering acquisition parameters and positioning. Clinical applications covered include cerebrovascular disease, acute and chronic ischemia and cerebrovascular reserve, dementia, and neuro-oncology. There are 15 figures and 227 references, so very useful article and well worth reading. On to number 7. This has a first author of Ronson, And this is entitled Pseudotumoral Presentation of Cerebral Amyloid Angiopathy Related Inflammation. This is from Neurology in 2016. The authors reviewed the characteristics of 5 newly diagnosed and 23 previously reported patients in whom cerebral amyloid angiopathy related inflammation findings were initially misinterpreted as neoplasms. Most cases, 85% or so, occurred in patients greater than 60 years old. The MR demonstrated infiltrative white matter lesions that exhibited mass effect without parenchymal enhancement. These findings were interpreted either as low-grade glioma or lymphoma. The primary reason for the misinterpretation, according to the authors, of the imaging findings was the absence of T2 star weighted gradient recalled echo sequences on the initial imaging study. Perfusion MR and MRS showed markedly reduced regional cerebral blood flow and a normal metabolic ratio, respectively. They concluded that T2 star or susceptibility weighted imaging should be performed during the diagnostic workup of brain masses, especially in elderly patients presenting with subacute cognitive decline and no parenchymal contrast enhancement. One figure and two tables. I'm not sure how lymphoma really got in the differential, since from the table that they include, only about 0 to 8% of these amyloid angiopathy cases showed enhancement. And as the authors note in the discussion, lack of enhancement in lymphoma is rare. On to number 8. As a first author of CORDJA, and it's entitled Controversies in Epidemiology of Intracranial Aneurysms and Subarachnoid Hemorrhage. This is from Nature Reviews in Neurology, and this is from 2015. The authors believe that the complex methodological challenges in conducting studies of epidemiology and risk factors for unruptured intracranial aneurysms and subarachnoid hemorrhage might have led to conclusions being drawn on the basis of epidemiologic data of variable quality. Therefore, they think misconceptions about unruptured intracranial aneurysms and subarachnoid hemorrhage have arisen. So this is called a perspectives article. They discuss 3 possible misconceptions about the epidemiology of unruptured intracranial aneurysms and subarachnoid hemorrhage. So they tackle 3 general topics. One is, do small unruptured intracranial aneurysms rupture? They say yes. Up to 85 to 90% of ruptured intracranial aneurysms are less than 10 millimeters in size. 70 to 80% are less than 7 millimeters, and 50% are less than 5 millimeters in size. Large population-based long-term studies from Finland and Norway have confirmed the overall risk of subarachnoid hemorrhage will depend on smoking, sex, and blood pressure. The second one they talk about is, can we learn from subarachnoid hemorrhage in Finland? They say, yeah. The reported incidence of subarachnoid hemorrhage in Finland is exceptionally high. The population-based and nationwide incidence rates of subarachnoid hemorrhage for very few countries are known. They argue that rejecting the external validity of the Finnish studies on the basis of incidence rates without having reliable estimates of subarachnoid hemorrhage incidence elsewhere in the world can affect the knowledge and understanding of the risk factors of subarachnoid hemorrhage. Thirdly, they consider familial is not equivalent to genetic. The statement that 10% of subarachnoid hemorrhage cases are associated with the family history of subarachnoid hemorrhage is often misinterpreted to mean that 10% of subarachnoid hemorrhages are familial. The incidence of a familial subarachnoid hemorrhage is low. 3% of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage have one first-degree relative with subarachnoid hemorrhage, and only 0.2% of patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage have 2 or more first-degree relatives with subarachnoid hemorrhage. And the last paper I'd like to talk about has a first author of Trey Tolt, and this is entitled A Systematic Review of Clinical and Surgical Predictors of Complications Following Surgery for Degenerative Cervical Myelopathy. This is from Journal of Neurosurgery Spine in 2015. The authors conducted a systematic review of the literature and determined that 60 studies met the inclusion criteria and were included in this review. These studies included 36 prognostic cohort studies and 28 comparative intervention studies. High-level evidence suggests that older patients are at a greater risk of perioperative complications. Based on low evidence, other clinical factors such as body mass index, smoking status, duration of symptoms, and baseline severity score are not predictive of complications. In regards to surgical factors, low to moderate evidence suggests that estimated blood loss, the surgical approach, and number of levels do not affect rates of complications. A longer operative duration, moderate evidence, however, is predictive of perioperative complications, and a two-stage surgery is related to an increased risk of major complications, and that's high evidence. They conclude that this knowledge will allow clinicians to identify high-risk patients and institute rigorous prevention strategies. Furthermore, surgeons can use this information to objectively discuss the surgical risks with their patients. Seems like a lot of work for some conclusions that are reasonably straightforward. So that was the list of 9 for this month. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. If you have feedback, please email me with your criticisms or praise at ajnr.eic@gmail.com. Again, the listings of these references will be in the blog for you if you want specifics on the citations. So till next time, thank you so much for listening.